writing of this paper was also affected, as one can expect, by my own experience as an Israeli born to a generation of immigrants who themselves, as youths, escaped from Europe, Germany and Austria during the Second World War. This paper is also a result of my understanding through my own analysis and digging deeper into the Jungian approach of the importance of historical social cultural factors in the outer and inner collective that affect the individual psyche, meaningfully attached to their own past. But what happens when the parents themselves are afflicted, torn away from their past and unable to transmit it? What if they can depend only on the future? What kind of conscious and unconscious messages does the child receive? What does it mean for him to grow up? Does he want to? Perhaps he had something worthwhile to say beforehand, as a child or as a poor. Before forcing him to grow up, we should try to hear and understand the call of the poor, remaining first in the archetypal realm and then moving from there to the personal level through the etiology and clinical pictures by which the condition reveals itself. Jung says, for anyone interested in the growth and development or redemption of the psyche from inner forces, the child generally and the poor archetype especially is full of great magic and mystery. Here we present what may be developed as that part of the man which is self-renewing. In another place, he speaks of him as a divine child, a deity representing the small seed at the beginning of something new in mankind. It grows, but someone must help him it to do it, even though it is divine. I quote him, he is both abundant and divinely powerful, a dual uniting figure which represents the insignificant beginning and then triumphal end. The eternal child in a man is both incongruity, handicap, and at the same time a divine prerogative, an imponderable worth or worthless of a personality. So we speak about the duality of the child. We had a lecture about the duality of the trickster, of the Hermes. So here is the duality of the child, which is also a uniting figure, but more with the other kind of energy of growth. Von Franz adds that the source of the poor is the child god in Eloise's mysteries. There is he born and appears in the mother mysteries of growth. He is like a redeemer, a god of life and death, resurrection and renewal. In actual time, says Jung, the poor will appear as a compensation for the older thoughts of older generation that have become petrified, stagnating the new ones and bringing disappointment to all. It seems that Jung speaks about a time of breakdown, a time of archetypal activation which needs renewal. A renewal based not only on returning to the past, but upon a new spirit, a new approach. But the new spirit manifested in the poor of fresh and promising energy needs to have continuity of some kind. It cannot exist in mid-air, cut off from the ground. Still at the archetypal level, two different points can be emphasized for better understanding of its nature. Von Franz emphasized the attachment of the poor to the mother archetypes, and according to her, he appears more as the son or lover, and not as the youth itself. Von Franz does not perceive him as a principle counter to the Senex, and in this way misses the whole issue of the social cultural collective and its possible fertilization by the inspirational nature of the poor. I think Hillman's emphasis is well placed. He's the one who developed the idea of poor Senex continuum and interaction as part of growth or as danger of being possessed and caught in the mire. Only in a situation of poor possession in the personal sphere of human complexes can a poor sometimes become united too closely with a mother complex or with some other complexes. But at the archetypal level, it must be examined separately. Like Jung, Hillman described the poor archetype as the principle of growth and renewal, the permanent spirit, a creative dynamic movement. Youth and freshness is not committed to heavy tradition and incorporates a great deal of naivete by its nature. In contrast to this, but not to be considered separately, is the Senex, the old man, personification of the archetypal principle of time, order, decisive principle, crystallization of laws and rules of this world and culture and history. According to this way of understanding the poor as part of the Senex poor continuum, we must examine the social-cultural background of the collective we are dealing with in order to give place to the Senex poor, and by so doing give some ground to our subject. Now, generation gaps, interchanges, and continuations are always difficult. But they are even more so in a period of cultural change, such as immigration, and worst of all, in the critical or traumatic states like those encountered after the Holocaust. To study the poor Senex subject in the Holocaust generation and the one after seem too extreme, and indeed it is. But I shall broaden it to include the issue of the new generation after a stress of immigration, with the hypothesis that in this typical forces migration of uprooted people, there are enhancing factor in both generations which cause the poor to be active. There is abrupt early weaning of the child, pseudo-maturity, and then, later in life, a clinging to adolescence and all its attendant phenomena. One important factor is the difficulty encountered by the previous generation, uprooted from its past, well-known surrounding and supportive social-cultural environment, and now having to adapt to the new ones to a certain extent dependent on the offspring, which I see as part of every immigration people, which they have to rely a bit on the children, which they are many times adapted earlier and quicker than the parents. So the children have a role in helping the parents in accommodating and adaptation. The issue we'll discuss according to Jung's and Ilman concept in the area. Now, to better understand the issue of the poor Senex as part of generation interaction and its impact on the individual at my country, it is necessary to understand it in the specific context of the new Israeli collective that has been established over the last 5 or 6 decades. And I'll talk about that a bit. I call it the new old collective. Israel, Alt Neuland, new old, as the visionary Theodor Herzl called it, is a state that was established mainly out of a mixed population of Jewish immigrants coming from all over the world, especially Europe and the Arab countries. Many of them came not for their own free will, but as refugees, fleeing from their countries of origin. Although they arrived while the nation was still fighting for its own existence and independence, Israel nevertheless was for them not merely a symbolic, but a real haven of refuge. Landing in the new homeland arose in most of these immigrants a series of new old feelings, even a sense of redemption. This new feeling of affiliation, reinforced by the deep, painful disappointments in their past, seemed to arouse in them enormous expectations and hopes. They tend to idealize the new nation and its Israeliness, and to degrade the past of the diaspora, the Jewishness. New Israeli tradition attempt to base itself, on the one hand, on the fresh new ideas of Zionism, on pioneering and making the desert bloom, and on the other hand, on the ancient promised land with its heroes and kings. The new Zionism tried to be more like the distant biblical past rather than like the recent Jewish past of diaspora. The new idealistic Israeli feels that he must be proud and strong with a head held high and shoulders back, like I'm standing here now, yeah? Almost. Active, contrasting to the picture of the weak, bent diaspora Jew. This marked the beginning of a painful split, albeit an artificial one, between the Israelis and the diaspora Jews, which would take years to heal. This led to a situation wherein people were encouraged to forget their past, the places they came from, and even their cultures. Some were even made to feel ashamed of their origins and their victimization, and try to hide it. Differences in people's past and cultures, and the uniqueness of each group, seemed to be regarded as a threat to the national unity. People became ambivalent toward their own identities. Denial of their origin caused considerable damage to the creative life of these people. And the collective, although not yet consolidated or based on its true foundations, assumed a large measure of power over the individual. The collective was very strong. Everybody must be like the collective is obeying to be. The basis of the new, inexperienced collective was quite dogmatic, nationalistic, unsure whether to be ideological, religious, or tribal in nature. There were strong influences of maternal and paternal archetypes projected onto the land, and past heroes and myths of old come alive once more. Also, the archetype of resurrection and rebirth, the one most relevant to our study of the poor, was felt everywhere. But one can add that behind all that, in the shadow, the picture of the wandering of the diaspora Jew, the Shtetl Jew, like we call it, from the little towns, from the Shtetl, who survived persecution and the wounds of the Holocaust, with its deep traumas, rages, and anxieties insidiously locked in. The father of one of my patients, the same patient that I brought the dream, wrote to him on the day of his bar mitzvah, which is the Jewish religious initiation which almost every child, religious or not, undergoes at the age of 13. To my son, he writes, with the present of the bar mitzvah, to my son, I could not sleep the whole night because I tried to look back, to sort things out and make things tangible, to feel that they are real. I cried and tried to imagine them, my parents, if they were with me. I was always alone except for the pain, only those tears and memories and longings. Never I had a day of joy, never real happiness, always the ghetto, the Great War, Auschwitz. No, no, you must not cry. You should not take a pill. You are not ill and you are not crazy. It is reality. Come back through the memories. You don't cure it. You don't anesthetize it. This is your life. And tonight you can celebrate. Because from that death, those ashes and blood, new life emerge. That is a boy, a Jewish boy. There is a boy, a Jewish boy, and a victory. This is our celebration. You are our victory. That is one of the few nights that I slept for a while without a pill. He gave that letter to the child in the bar mitzvah, and the patient brought it to me as a letter. He he had it for many years in his album, the pictures. From the collective and its characteristics, let us turn to the smaller unit in which the actual generation interchange is taking place. There the child is raised and socialized and receives most of his ability to become an adult in a given society. I want to stress only some of the points in this system of the parent-child in the family. I wouldn't cover them all, which is a very mutually sensitive system. That's what I want to stress. Our parents are a great part of the fate which determine our purpose in life. They are supposed to deliver us from archetypal world, humanizing the archaic one, leading us to healthy childhood and reality, and helping us pass from childhood to adulthood. They must help us become attached to the society and culture in which we live, and we, in turn, must do the same for our children. It is also well known today, and important to mention here, that the child himself has a great influence on his parents. We speak of parenthood as a kind of self-correction and development for the parents as well. It is the child who symbolizes hope for the future and new possibilities, as Jung emphasized it when he speaks of the child archetype. Through the child archetype, which is of a great fascination and has the power of truth and strength to become real, we relate to our own future. The child archetypes bring out the most authentic dedication to our own future and truth. We can add that this is what the parents project onto his child and in its birth, giving the child great importance in its own right. Neumann speaks of the projection of the mother self onto the infant child. It seems that this mutual influence and expectation has been manifested in many different versions throughout life. We also know now sensitive children can be to their parents' needs and distresses, even before they grow up themselves. That is a very important point. It was Alice Miller who introduced the term the gifted child, the child who is especially sensitive to his parents' need and probably damage his own self by being too devoted to his parents' wounds. It is also well known that this mutually sensitive parent-child system has a strong impact on the child's psyche, also influence its ego strength, its maturity, and the rapidity of its growth, especially when the parent has undergone a trauma. When we analyze the various factors in that system in a condition of immigration and try to determine which of them is crucially important for enabling us to understand the etiology of the poor, we see that there are those of the parents and those of the children. I will mention some of the parents and some of the children variables which are crucial to understand this emergence of the poor. The parents' factor are the wounds sustained on tearing away from his family and his previous culture, which I think is very important. Failure to adapt to the new environment, which leads to more relying on the child. Detachment from inner child in him, which can be a problem not only in the immigration. Depression at having given up on meaning of his own personal self, of the parent. The impossible expectation, both conscious and unconscious, he had from the child. And last but not least, his ability or inability to pass his child through the world of society and culture outside. Now, the child's factors are, which part of them I'm bringing here, sensitivity and intuition of the child, ability to read the parents' messages. The child who can read the parents' messages will be more susceptible. The need of the child to help the parents emotionally. It is the creative spiritual child, one who is more open to the archetypal world and especially that of the parents, who will be tuned into them and will be more susceptible. It is also expected that it is the child with greater social and cultural spiritual needs which have not been met who will feel the split in the parents' identity and will suffer. Now I would like to turn into the family of the Holocaust survivors. Those who survived the Holocaust were in most cases the only ones remaining in their families. They were in a state of abandonment, post-trauma, wounded at all the level of their existence. It is the majority of this family, silence was maintained about what had happened during the catastrophe, both in those years and for many years following. But they were still in a state of fear of annihilation. And for them to have a part in building a new country, creating a new family, and having children was the most important and healing thing. In the first place, it symbolizes life and continuity. Their children in their new home become the sunshine, source of warmth and light for the parents. Second, it was a proof of victory over the Nazi intention to destroy the nation. These children become raison d'etat for their parents' life. There is a great deal of research describing the parents' great expectation from their children, claiming them as compensation for the loss and making them take over as a substitute for those destroyed. I would not mention here all the research in this area, but there's a lot. Rather than being individuals in their own right, the children became symbols of their parents' loss. It appears then that the expectation and compensation projected onto the child and his role of memorial to his parents' loss were the reason for the severe separation and individuation difficulties which most of these children suffer. From all the research around this issue, it seems that both generations suffered unavoidable pain. The parents build their own identity around their children, the new generation, while their own lives were restricted to surviving, having been cut off from their inner life and their past. The children gave up their own selves, now becoming the hopes, promises, and extension of the parents, as we have seen in the torchbearer dream described that I told you in the beginning. Why might then ask why in such a situation, being such a support and being rewarded for maturity, the child chooses instead to become a poor, refusing to assume adult state? In such a stressful situation, it would appear easier to understand children that successfully pass through adolescence without crisis, but pay the price of getting caught in the Senex state. It could be more understandable, that's what I think. They continue to be the serious ones, meeting the norms of the collective through the expectation of the parents, and build up even earlier a false mature self as a way of existence. But what about the poor? What are they aiming at? That's one of the questions we must answer here. In this presentation, I would like to concentrate on the poor types, on to whom the characterization of poor adolescent personality has been thrust. They have qualities and weaknesses specific to them that push them toward the poor side rather than toward the Senex. We will present here three case vignettes of youngsters who come to analysis with poor problems. All of them were youthful and creative, wore sunny smiles, and were full of enthusiasm. They were very sensitive to the analyst, carrying a sense of hidden omnipotence and ambitious to do something especially important and meaningful. Inwardly, though, they felt very old, tired, and detached, saying that they knew exactly what it meant to be grown up to them. To them, it seemed that it was no glick, we say, a luck, something with something special. It means being unattractive, empty, and depressed, with no creative soul. In all the cases, one can feel the pressure on the child of his or her importance to the parents and an enormous need to satisfy the parents, even to the extent of saving them by sacrificing themselves. I will present first case of, of a woman by the name of Bina. Bina is a daughter of two parents who lost all of both their families in the Holocaust, but themselves survived. Unfortunately, Bina's parents also lost their eldest son in the army when she was 14, which can happen also in our country. Losing a brother was a disaster for Bina, being caught in the demanding, guilt-provoking behavior of her mother, who had every right to be and was a miserable after the loss. As always, Bina felt that she had no right to feel her own loss because it was her duty to take care of her mother. Bina came to analysis when she was already 30, filled with doubts about everything in her life and worried at her inability to maintain relationship. She worked as a lawyer, changing jobs every some months, and the thing that she most liked to do is traveling outside the country. She saved all her money in going to make trips. And she had no wish to continue in her profession. She always had doubts that she might change the profession. She was divorced, having realized very early that her marriage, like her studies, has been for her mother's happiness, and that she had, in any case, failed performing her task. In analysis, Bina's transference to me was like a continuation of a feeling for a big brother she had lost. But there was also a period when she felt all kind of feeling toward her parents, including, like to her mother, a great concern for me, especially when she wanted to take a break from the analysis and to go for some months to the Far East. She really cared that she felt guilty that she's abandoned me or something. How would I feel? I accepted the trip as a part of the need to go her own way and helped her to feel less guilty about fulfilling it. On the surface, it appears that her mother wanted her to enter the mainstream of life and was concerned only about Bina's happiness and success. But aided by the analysis, Bina understood the unconscious messages she was getting from her mother, but had not realized before. I suffered much in life. I am miserable and a victim. You are strong, happy, and beautiful. I brought you into this world not the way that any other boys and girls were brought by their parents. Your duty is to take care of me and make me happy. This is something you can do. You have that power. You must go and study a good, decent profession, and you will save me and compensate me for what I missed. Bina's relationship with her father was a bit different because he was more affectionate to her, but the manifestation of this relationship were covered and took place out of mother's sight. In her analysis, Bina became aware of how much she carried on her own shoulders and what kind of grandiose expectation her parents project onto her, in which she is so willingly accepted. She also understood what kind of role she played in her parents' life and between them, and how much of her true self she had given up for the sake of that role. The only true side of herself which she felt was her poor side, all the going abroad and not committed to anything and doing, changing and writing and painting and all these things. She was already to give up this facet of her life, fearing that in doing so, she might be throwing out the baby together with the dirty bathwater. She wanted to understand what more there was in life that could give her reason to live. And the thoughts brought on a great deal of depression in the treatment. It was difficult for Bina to discard her overinflated feeling of omnipotence, give up her mission to save her mother, and start healing her own wounds. She needed to mourn the inadequate childhood, which she would never be able to retrieve. In the analysis, Bina began to do things which she had always really wanted. Like I told you before, she was free to do what she wanted at first. After touring most of Europe, including Poland, her parents' country of origin, now lost to them, she calmed down. Finally, too, she found what she really wanted to do. She had begun working as a lawyer in an office offering a free welfare services to the poor, which had given her great satisfaction. She married an immigrant from South America, and much to her mother's displeasure, goes with him to Argentina every summer. She had now had second child and described herself as much more mature. Her life now, much lower key, and she sometimes become very depressed. But on the whole, she's now feel much more free and full of interest. Both she and her husband, especially after the marriage, have become drawn much closer to Jewish tradition. She is now not naive as she once more. Her life has fewer ups and downs, and certainly there is much more meaning to it. Now, Dina Vardi, an Israeli writer, and psychologist and writer, in her book on the second generation, writes about two main messages transmitted for the parents to their children and sealed in the soul, the way she writes it. The first is to remind the world what happened in the Holocaust, and the second, to fill the void created by the loss of the dearest ones. On the one hand, it would seem that they had to continue to play the role of those that had been lost. But on the other, for them, there was no real attachment to the past. Anything before the Second World War just wasn't there. So the message was, you are the generation that must continue, but behind us, there is only destruction, death, and emotional vacuum. You have to build the family and the nation, and sometimes even to give your life for them. And underneath, of course, were the shadowy emotions of deprivation and sometimes even a hidden envy from the parents to the children. In the next case, we encounter a hero, a brave and strong. We have already heard his father's letter to him and his dream about the torch. His name is Yuval. For Yuval to come to analysis was another new injury. He had always thought of himself as strong, brave, young, and talented, with no need of anyone's help. He was the apple of his anxious, depressed, but ambitious father's eye, and also of his poor mother, a Holocaust survivor. His parents found each other on their way to Israel. They did not acclimatize well to the new country, and Yuval was always ashamed of the old world behavior. He sought treatment because of the symptoms he was presenting. Panic attacks, jumpiness, wild gesture, and no rest. Otherwise, he would not have come to the treatment. He suffered. That's what brought him. And we can talk after a while, when the poor are coming to treatment, not all of them coming. He jumped from job to job, unable to find real interest in any of them. He began every new enterprise with a burst of excitement, which faded very quickly. He took a wife, knowing he would leave her soon after. One foot was already on the way out. He was very fast, intuitive, and full of ideas which he never could apply. Here he was writing a book and then composing a new song. There he has just found a wonderful new puella, but tomorrow he will meet the true one. Yeah? From adulthood, Yuval had to face his broken father trying hard to read his needs, frustration, and inability to be happy. His fantasies fluctuate between becoming a millionaire, saving his father from his feeling of being poor, and being an artist, because he was very creative, talented, and musical. Now, the dream I would not repeat again. You remember the dream with the church. And I want to speak about the dream. If you remember, the situation created in dreams was clear. Yuval began to realize the role he plays in his family and his life anywhere, not only in the family itself. This kind of, to build, bear the torch was something continuing in other places in life. He talked of what he did in the army, the risk he took, the sacrifices he made, his readiness to do anything in order to save others, and to be the officer of whom the father was so proud. For Yuval, coming to analysis was like a period of labor. That's in, not in the beginning, but with the time. He confesses how afraid he was, how childish he was underneath, and how much he wanted someone to discover his disguise. In the transference, Yuval was very occupied with the mood of a therapist. Sometimes he was more sensitive to me, my moods, health, and expectation than I was myself. He knew how to satisfy and be the star patient. There was much twinship transference and a feeling of brotherhood that was good and healing, probably for both participants. After taking up his role as a savior, Yuval calmed down and gradually revealed and confronted his poor inflation, which was part of him. We will talk about his, the way he likes to glide to acting and creating in all kinds of art forms. He preferred to change partners and remain totally free from any commitment. Analysis made him aware of his omnipotence powers and his wish to do something great and important for his family and for the nation. But underneath was the need to save his father in order to have one. Yuval also revealed a great deal of spiritual interest, and in the analysis it shifted to a greater interest in his father's family, past, and culture. This came gradually in the analysis. Yuval discovered that he has grown up without a father, without anyone to guide him, with no cultural heritage or past or any real tradition. He came to realize how different he felt from the typical Israeli man. He suddenly discovered how Jewish and how much more European he is, and it gave his identity a new dimension. Like Bina, Yuval painfully had to give up his torch and his inflated feeling and being and begin to heal his own wounded feet. It was difficult and painful to mourn his inability to be a proper child, stealing a bit of it like a thief whenever he could. Later, Yuval gave up his torch only when he could have another kind of light, another consciousness for his own true self. Now, from the chilling description of the family, we see more and more the feeling of emptiness into which they were born, depression, death, and a sense of the role that were assigned. It seems that they were the ones who were more sensitive to the parents and to the cultural and spiritual matters. On the one hand, they carry a load charged with death, loss, guilt, and crucifixion, but hopes, promise, and redemption on the other, which is part of a poem.